You are listening to the You Are Techie podcast, episode number 92.
Welcome to the You Are Techie podcast, where it's all about growing in your techiness so you can find the tech job of your dreams. And now your host, technology learning coach, Ellen Toomey.
Hey moms, are you trying to break into tech? Are you wondering what skills you really need to get hired? And how those skills can be worth $45 an hour? Not that $25 an hour you thought when you first started thinking about going back to work? If so, then the You Are Techie membership is for you. Our combination of courses, coaching, and community come with the mentor support you need to keep moving forward into your tech career. It's like no other membership available. We have the exact skills employers are looking for. You'll learn how to maximize your income with portfolio-ready skills that hiring managers are seeking, not to mention the steps you can skip so you don't find yourself down that endless tech learning rabbit hole. Join me as we walk you step-by-step through the getting hired process in tech. Sign up at youaretechie.com. That's youaretechie.com. I can't wait to see you in our membership. Nick Cooley is the director of UX engineering at BlackRock. His storied technical career spans 20 years demonstrating skills in everything, from prototyping to Ajax to architecture. He has extensive e-commerce experience and has worked on pretty much every aspect of the front end, including spending significant time on UX. Nick graduated from the University of Michigan with a BA in Communications and Media Studies. He has held positions such as Senior Interaction Designer, Senior Interface Architect, Principal Front-End Architect, as well as VP of Engineering and Senior Director of Web Engineering prior to joining BlackRock as the Director of UX Engineering. Nick has worked as a Thinkful mentor, as well as a volunteer as a dishwasher for Rosie's Place serving meals to victims of domestic violence. Nick lives in Wayland, Massachusetts with his wife, two boys, their two dogs, and a hamster. Nick also happens to be a friend from high school who I haven't talked to in years. I won't say how many. And I'm looking really forward to our conversation. Nick, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So first of all, how have you been for a couple decades?
Yeah, right. I look the same. Not much has changed. I have as much hair on the top of my head as I did then.
That's impressive, by the way.
No, I don't. I'm starting to lose it.
lots on the face, though.
That's the transplant. Yeah, I took it from here and put it down here. So that was the goal. But I'm great. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm really interested in your career journey. And I mean, I said some of those things in the intro. You worked as a Thinkful mentor. You served as a dishwasher for Rosie's Place. When I saw that I saw it on Facebook that you got this new position. I'm like, oh my gosh, I need to have Nick on because I think that it speaks to your heart as much as your knowledge. So like if someone looks at your technical background, they're like, oh my gosh, he's so, you know, I know my audience will be like, he is super technical. He knows so much, but I'll just say it. You're also just a really great guy. And so I love that because I think that knowing that you get to work with good people is part of what attracts people to certain roles. So I'd love to hear just about your career journey, because you didn't really think you were going to start out in tech and then how you ended up where you are now.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate the, you know, I don't know how nice a guy I am in terms of that, but I do believe in giving back. And, you know, our high school environment was a big part of that because, you know, it's like they forced us into volunteer work. So I learned volunteerism.
Required hours.
I had to do my 10 hours of community service.
We had to do 40. We had to do way more than the guys.
Ours was like nothing.
Just so everyone understands, I went to an all girls school. Nick went to the all boys school, like 5 feet away. Yeah. You would howl at us. I mean,
there was a moat.
Yeah, there was a moat.
A bridge. Yeah, it was very medieval, very metaphorical. Right. And so I think what's interesting, first and foremost, as you're reading all of those titles and the things that I had, it's like, it's funny how so many different industries, companies, whatever, have different titles for what we do that, you know, I started, at this point, my first role in technology was as an intern my junior year in college. So about 22 years ago, I was called an interaction /technical associate. So the interaction design was kind of what we would call a UX designer today, right?
Right.
Like I do wireframes, I do sitemaps, I do, you know, red lines, things like that. And but it's very, you know, unlike today where UX designers are using Sketch or Figma, like they're making very, I don't want to say pixel perfect designs, but they're making interactive prototypes of things. Like mine was, you know, I'm in Illustrator making these very plain black and white lined, very outlined. And, you know, it's like what you would put on the page, not where or how it would look, right? Like, and we still have visual designers in what we do. Growing up, this notion of being an internet person or working in the internet, just it wasn't something that I knew anyone could do. So I went to college, like not knowing like what I was going to do. Mm-hmm. And my junior year, I got a sense that I wanted to do something with technology, computer science, something like that. And so mm-hmm. I thought, okay, I'm going to start taking some CS classes and I'm going to, you know, let's see what happens. And so I took, you know, CS 101 and it was like, okay, now we're starting to write in C or C++. And it's like, okay, that's cool. But it's like, I like this thing called the web, but this isn't the web. This is like classical object-oriented programming. It's different, right? And what I learned was all through college, and it's true even today, I don't know what it's going to take for them to get to the point where they're going to teach somebody how to be a web developer or a web programmer. I mean, the closest I've seen is we'll teach Java or Python in college,
right?
But they're not focused as a concentration on the web technologies. I got a fateful call from one of our classmates from high school, and he was over at MIT and he had been interning for this startup. And he says, hey, you want to come up for the summer and be an intern? And I'm like thinking to myself, what are you guys doing? And he's like, well, you know, we're building internet sites and stuff like that. I'm like, oh, this is interesting. Like this is, it's kind of like what I want to do, right? Like, right. Or it's, I wanted to see if it's something I wanted to do. So why not? So I went out to Boston my junior year and I just worked on stuff and I built, you know, websites and I learned about HTML. I was building tables and, you know, cutting images and stuff like that. And I loved it. And it was like, I could just do that forever. Everyone in senior years is interviewing for jobs and they're talking about all the different companies they're interviewing with. I made one call and I said, I'm going to go back to this company and I'm going to, you know, I'm going to start my journey.
And did you stay in Boston since then?
Yeah, I've been
in Boston now.
Mm-hmm, yeah, I've been in the greater Boston area ever since. You know, I might have taken for granted a lot of what opportunity I was being provided in that first role. And the way I think about my career, it's like theater production. It's like I'm in the second act of my career right now. But the first 10 years was like all consulting. So I got to work with a lot of different technologies, with a lot of different companies. And it helped my ADD for learning because every 6 months I'd be on a new project where I could completely choose a new tech stack and be like, oh, I want to learn this one or it's the right one for this.
And the companies value that. They're like, okay, hey, here's what we're doing. Jump in. But really it was this experience at Zephyr where you were, you know, doing the work. Because we talked about this identity a little bit, right? Like you just started doing the work and that's how you became associated with that. And I know you were looking into UR Techie and you mentioned like Atomic Habits. And I want to talk a little bit about your Thinkful mentorship and what that was like and just being a mentor and what was that experience of being a mentor like?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because having read Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg, you know, there's a whole topic on mentorship or a whole chapter on mentorship and her philosophy. And I tend to agree with it is you don't just magically one day, like say to somebody, I'm going to become your mentor. I'm going to, you know, ta-da, like, or and likewise, you don't just go up to somebody and ask them, hey, excuse me, can you be my mentor?
Will you be my mentor?
It doesn't work like that. And especially in roles where I'm in a leadership role and I'm in a people management role, what I tend to say is we're going to have a weekly one-on-one. It's 30 minutes to an hour a week. And that is my time dedicated to you to use however you want. And here's my offer. I offer you all the mentorship like that I can. I am willing to active verb mentor you. You need to take the reins of leading that mentorship, as in like asking questions or, you know, having a direction you want to go or whatever. But I feel that anyone who ever reports to me or works with me, they are entitled to, it's their inalienable right by process of working with me. Like, they're entitled to mentorship. Mm-hmm. And if, God forbid, down the road, we build a good rapport and relationship and a mentor relationship comes out of that, great, awesome. But it's not a, it's like, I had to learn that it's not like, it's not a destination, just like you brought up Atomic Habits, right? It's kind of the opposite of that. It's like, is like in Atomic Habits, you know, and in and the notion of being techie or whatever, when it involves you yourself, right? It's best to identify with that, that thing that you want to be. So in the case of you are techie, right? It's not, I want to be techie. It's that today I make a decision to be techie. And mm-hmm. every day from here on out, I'm going to do at least one thing that's going to get me feeling more techie than the last. But make no mistake about it. You know, yesterday I was not techie and today I am techie. And,
yeah.
you know, I think the way that I experienced it, and this is why in some cases it was challenging for me, is, you know, use the example of smoking, right? Like, I in college picked up the nasty habit of having a cigarette every once in a while. And so at one point and many points thereafter, you know, you go through a phase in which you call like, I'm trying to quit. And when you're trying to quit, right, like the goal is that you're going to quit for good. So you're out and about in a similar social setting that you would have been in, and somebody offers you a cigarette and you say, no, thanks, I'm trying to quit. Well, why? Right. Why say that? Right. Like, you're either, why wouldn't you say I'm not a smoker? Right. Like,
right.
It would there's what they call a rub, right? Like that you might be trying to get, right? Like, I identify with you and I'm trying to get credit for being, for having been a smoker. I'm also trying to get credit for attempting to quit. So I still identify with myself as a smoker or a former smoker. There's still part of me that identifies there. And I'm letting you know that that I'm trying to quit. I'm not necessarily like that. There's still a possibility that I might take that cigarette from
right.
you.
Right. No, for now, but maybe later.
Like, ask me, give me a drink and ask me in 10 minutes. And the answer might be yes. So that's with anything in life that you're trying to like change your identity. Right. And it's not that you're trying to change who you are fundamentally. Like, certainly in identifying with a career trajectory or in, like, who am I fundamentally? Like, I think, yes, you can change who you are, but there's a lot of times where it's like, okay, I'm a person who does X, Y, and Z. What you do, you can change who you are. It, that obviously comes later on down the road, but this is like, okay, I want to identify myself as, right. as techie, or I want a career in technology. Well, let's that one's a goal and the other is a state of being. Right.
Right.
And the problem with goals is that, you know, we strive to achieve the goal. And we think that once we get to the goal, bam, like all of a sudden things are going to be different or something's going to be different. And the reality is a lot of times you see some other milestone or whatever, and that's fine. And again, having goals is fine. But in the case of trying to change something fundamental about yourself,
yeah,
and there's no cost to do it, right? Like, I think a lot of times people have an imposter syndrome, myself included, where it's like, oh, I don't feel like, I feel like I'm lying, or I feel like I'm this right. or that. In a lot of cases, that doesn't matter, right? Your insecurity around this new role or this new challenge is irrelevant, because nobody's going to judge you for saying I'm techie or I'm pursuing a career in engineering or whatever. And I think that that's liberating, right? The notion of letting go of the insecurity or the imposter syndrome that says I shouldn't feel this way, or I shouldn't feel entitled to do this. Right.
Yeah. I don't deserve it. I don't deserve
right.
to say.
Yeah. yeah. It's one thing to say I deserve a job. I think everyone deserves a job, right? Like, in doing what they want. But it's one thing to say a company will hire me based on my progression as being techie right now. A lot of times it just might not be the right fit, right? Like, it might have nothing to mm-hmm. do with whether or not you're techie, you know, in one way or another. A friend of ours from high school has moved into acting and has been in some really amazing stuff.
I know. I saw that. He was with Clint Eastwood.
He was in Marvel. It was amazing.
I was like, why is this guy? What was it? I was watching the movie. I'm like, that looks so familiar. Yeah. I couldn't believe it. Yeah. Eugene Cordero. Way to go. Yeah.
And I've heard stories, not from him, but from like what acting is like. Right. Like, and it's like you go to these auditions. Right. And it's soul crushing, because all you want is to get the role, right? And you see yourself as somebody who gets the role. And in reality, what a job looks like for the casting director is we're looking for something very specific. And if you happen to fit this very narrow definition of what we're looking for, then you'll get the role. And oh, by the way, it's like 500 people might audition for one role. Right. And so like the odds, it's like winning the lottery. And so what as an actor you can do is prepare yourself in training and in whatever to just be prepared for as many of those circumstances as possible. But, you know, again, at any given point, a role might just not be for you. And
but also prepare yourself for like 9 times out of 10 rejection.
Absolutely. Yes.
I mean, maybe it's 99. I don't know. But that I feel like that's a really great example, actually, because so in my program, it's about getting hired. Right. So there's the interview process and there's this evaluation. And it's really I don't know how similar or not similar it is to acting, but it sounds like a good analogy. And they have this hurdle. My students have this hurdle of the portfolio. And I can just tell you the reality is I have these two students. They're really great. And one has a portfolio. Amazing, like really good. I've seen some other portfolios. Let's just say from outside of my program that were fine too. But my student's portfolio is excellent. She has not been hired yet. Really close. So probably by the time this year, this other student does not have a portfolio, has been hired. So a lot of times they're like, well, you know, going back to this identity thing, well, once I have the portfolio, then I've proven that I get to say that I am this and then I earn it and then I get hired. But the reality is that isn't always the path that happens.
No. At most times, depending on whether or not you're a designer, like the portfolio to me is very important. If you're going into design, yeah, it's a very visual thing. If you're going into engineering, all you got to do is pass that code test, right? And yeah. Let me tell you, there's something about how we code test in companies these days. It's like the hazing of our industry where, you know, some companies do it just to see how you handle it. Some company, and they give you these really obscure, not relevant as a question in an interview is like, how many golf balls can you fit in a school bus? I'm like, I'm sorry, can you tell me how that's going to be applicable to the job that we're going to do here? And it was like, that was one of them. But for me,
just a minute, because on my list of questions is your two secret weapon interview questions. And this is not one of them. So the question was, how many golf balls can you fit on a school bus?
Yeah.
And you were like, no, I'm not going to answer that.
Well, I wish. And it wasn't that. So when I got that question, I knew the intent wasn't for me to tell him a specific number of it's frustrating for me as somebody who's going to go out and try and find jobs. And this is, again, individual contributor, probably 10 years into my career, I got this question. And so you think about it and you think about, OK, well, you know, first off, you line them up in a certain way. And then if you know, what does a row of golf balls look like? And then, oh, wow, what can you do with like half space? Can you cut a golf ball in half and like fill up? You know, it's like, it's fine, but it had nothing to do with anything that this job was going to do. And in some cases, you ask those questions, number one, to see how is somebody going to handle like a very difficult question or how are they going to get flustered? Are they going to, you know, whatever. Other times, you know, they'll ask questions like, oh, what are your favorite sites on the internet? And it was funny because I used ESPN as an example, but not because ESPN is the subject matter, but because of how advanced they were in digital media and what they were doing with video. And the interviewer kind of scoffed at me like after like, oh, and they were, she was from Montreal, I think. And it was a Zoom call and she kind of scoffed at me in the interview. And I was like, that's like demotivating. And I'm like not getting a good relief. You know, it's not. It's,
right. But, it doesn't mean it's bad because it's a topic that. So often
interviewing feels confrontational. And this is why people develop phobias around interviews and tech interviews in particular, because it's very difficult to know exactly how they're going to come at you, right? And so for your students who are thinking about different roles and whatever, it's like, I go back to acting and I say, if you're in search of a job or in a role, yes, you can spend hours a day on LeetCode and practice coding examples and stuff like that. You can, you know, go to your favorite websites and see what's great about their code or what. There's work that you can do just like as an actor. You can take improv classes and you can, you know, you can go to ballet or, you know, whatever. There's a whole world of skill sets that make up a good I would say citizen in this space. And at any point in time, if you're looking for a job or if you've got spare cycles and you're trying to figure out how do I leverage that, build a side project, the notions of portfolios, I think are fine, but what as a potential hiring manager, it looks like to me, and I don't know if this is fair or not, but they become very predictable, or the question of, okay, like somebody was guided through this process of building this thing rather than they built this thing themselves.
Right. Yes.
And it's kind of the same thing when I'm looking, like if I'm sourcing candidates for a role, I won't name names, but there are certain coding boot camps or organizations that take the candidate's photo behind a very specific backdrop.
And you always know what it is.
And it's like the same every time. And it's like, if you had never seen it, you might think, oh, okay, that's interesting. But once you key into it and they keep using the same one, it's like, it kind of is like, oh yeah, okay, this is somebody who's out of a boot camp or out of whatever. And to be clear, I think boot camps are fine. Coding skills and workshops are great. But I think what becomes not great is that somebody finishes like one of those. Not that you're not techie, because you are techie. You're on the journey of techiness. You're on the continuum. But there's more that you can do to meet the criteria of this job. It's not just like, okay, I'm going to go take this boot camp. Right. I'm going to be done. Yes. And now I'm going to get the job. Yes. It's not that.
It's not that ever. It's a learning process. And that's, I'm glad to hear you say that, because I've really struggled in my program. I do not offer a template for a portfolio. I'm like, no, because the best portfolios are the ones that have some creativity to it. And I have a checklist, like, here's what you need in it, but not how to do it. Okay. So let me ask you this. So you're going to interview people. I need to know what you like to ask. What are your two secret weapon interview questions? They love this one.
When I think about the interview, like I said, so I've already outlined kind of what I don't like about interviews. So generally
not asking the golf ball bus question.
No, and it doesn't mean that I won't ask a coding question. So like, that's okay. But I will say, when I'm interviewing for a role, I have a question that I ask, which I think would be good for your audience. And that's, I think a lot of people ask the question like, oh, what does it take to succeed in this role? Or what are you looking for that someone's going to do in this role? And it's going to be, you're going to be great. I tend to ask the opposite question. I tend to ask, why would someone fail in this role? Why would someone, you'd go through the interviewing process, you'd say, yep, okay, this is the person, but somehow, some way we missed something or whatever. And that sounds like a really negative Nancy kind of way to ask the question.
I love it. Yeah.
But what I find is interviewers tend to have more concrete examples of times that we've failed or times that things have failed versus like successes. And obviously, if things were all rosy and going great at the company, they wouldn't be hiring for this role, maybe necessarily. So I like to kind of go about it at that way. And of course, every time I ask the question, someone says, oh, what an interesting question. And it's like, well, it's because I know someone's failed at either in the culture or in the organization or in that specific role.
Yeah.
And I'm going to get more insight on that and what they're looking for. Yes. Then I would, if it's like, okay, we're all like this, because a lot of times someone will self-identify with a certain like corporate belief that isn't necessarily resonant.
Isn't true.
Ask for forgiveness. It's better to ask for forgiveness, right? When it's like, no, you get in trouble when you screw up like that or whatever. but if a culture is good with fail fast, which I am a big believer in, it's like failing fast is one of the best ways to succeed in a role. And as long as you have the latitude to do that in your job, then that's great. That's usually where I start. That's the first interview question. And then when I'm asking the questions, if it's a front end question, and it's funny because it's so basic and it's so simple, but I ask, it's JavaScript based, and I usually focus on, okay, let's use vanilla JavaScript. Let's not use jQuery. Let's not use, React or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to give you 5 buttons. Markup, the HTML markup is 5 buttons, and there's no title, there's no label, there's nothing other than these 5 buttons on the page. And I want you to click each one of these buttons, and I want to get something in the console that's like, its ordinal position on the page. And you can't add markup, you can't add classes. You can't add IDs. You got to tell me how to, you know, query the markup, put on the event listener, and figure out how to get me the ordinal position in numerical fashion, you know, correctly. And 10 years ago, it was a much harder question than it is today, because, you know, it required you to use Clojure and all this stuff. The query selector API wasn't a part of the browser at that time. And so, like 10 years ago, there were gotcha parts of it. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, it's like, okay, you can iterate through the buttons and do this. But
interesting. That's a good one. That's really specific. I love it.
Well, but getting somebody, especially if it's a front end role, because what I find is people want to use those crutches of, I want to add something to the markup, right? Like the first thing is, I want to add a class or I want to add an ID. And it's like, okay, great. What if you can't do that? Right?
Yeah.
And it really requires you to understand the iterator and understand, you know, in the Clojure days, what would happen is if you didn't wrap it in a Clojure, you'd get 5 every time, because the Clojure, it goes through the loop, and the loop is in a state at the very end, no matter what button you're picking. But if you do it in a Clojure, you're putting in state that like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So it would show like when people were, and so again, it's very simple. It's very specific. It required the use of Clojure. It required the use of understanding iterators and Clojure. It required not being like held on to the crutch of like some framework or whatever. I mean, if they said, okay, I'm not sure how to do that, can you, you know, then I'll like, there are levels of this, right? Like, so I'd say, okay, fine. Show me jQuery or show me whatever. And then you'd know kind of where someone was. But yeah, that's the other one that, again, I ask actually less and less these days, but I will still pull it out because I think it's applicable and it's not as hard as people think. I think the most important thing that I do in an interview is I tell them, you can ask any question of me you want. You can't, you know, treat me like your personal Google, because I want to know what you're searching or what you like, how you would approach this. Just the same way that someone wanted to know how I think about golf balls in school buses. Mm-hmm. I want to know how you would approach this thing, especially if you're going to start having trouble with it. Like, help me understand how you'd try and get yourself out of this hole. Mm. And because again, my goal is to be as empathetic to the candidate and to not have this whole gotcha culture where someone comes out of that interview and says, oh my God, that interview sucked. Cause like,
right.
They were so right. Like, I've been in interviews where I came out and the bad taste that was left in my mouth, you know, it's like, I think about some interview techniques at like computer science is almost like magic school, right? You learn a whole bunch of tricks, bubble sort and binary search and whatever. Yeah. And you learn it in this secret society. And then when you go into these interviews, they're basically asking you to do the magic trick for them so that like you can demonstrate, okay, I learned that thing or whatever. And that's not what I want. I want it to be as inclusive as possible. And I want to allow for multiple possibilities for solving problems, because at the end of the day, yes, everything has a cost, right? Like there's complexity and time, right? Like that you can do the big O notation and analysis and like say, okay, this is not the most efficient loop that I could have come up with or whatever. But it's like, that's not what most people in companies are looking for. I think a lot of times, the lack of talent, like the supply and the demand is so out of whack right now, especially coming out of COVID.
Yes.
You know, they talk a lot about the great resignation, right? Like people are going
to
be
looking. That's the polite way to say it. Yeah.
Right. Well, and I'm still trying to figure out if it means people will have jobs, like as in people will be leaving their jobs, of course, but that more jobs will be opening up, or it's just going to be kind of musical chairs a little bit. And so I know, and even without that, I know companies are hiring. And so it's a matter of just finding those companies and understanding what their needs are. If it's a company that you like, study, research the company and figure out what do you like about that company. Maybe it means taking a role that's a little less prominent than you thought, or a little less senior maybe than you thought. It might mean taking an internship with a company, but you know,
get in the door and get the experience.
Yeah, because I promise you, if you've got the time and, you know, you've got the will to prove yourself in that company, companies tend to value good work ethics and good people more than the best programmer in the world, right? Like if you can do the job and you're going to get it done on time, and you're going to get it done of a certain quality, and you're going to be pleasant to work with and a good coworker. A lot of times that's more important than being like the hotshot coder who knows they're hot and like whatever.
Right. And also what I tell my students a lot too, because I, and one of my good friends is a recruiter, and like that programmer you just described comes at a completely different rate than somebody who's trying to break in. And you need a lot of people who are like the low, not the more entry level
end of things, because a company has to be balanced. They can't hire all hotshot programmers.
That's right. And I think there are some companies that are going to be more willing to mentor.
Yeah, for sure.
People than others. And like, again, that's okay. Right. I know when I was a startup, I was at a startup and I was hiring for a role. I had three engineers and one of them was relatively junior. So I knew at that time, I need someone who's a little bit more senior. But if I was all senior, I may have been able to take on somebody more junior, because yeah, that blended rate of your payroll is really important. Well, I think what I've learned is that younger people who learn a lot at a company are more likely to stay longer term than somebody who jumps in and isn't learning a lot. They're just kind of doing what they're doing. Although these days it's like, it seems like there's a revolving door every 2 years, but I have seen success with homegrown. It's like baseball or whatever, you know, if it's somebody who's homegrown, you know, maybe they have fondness for that.
For sure. They cut their teeth there. They feel like they can continue to grow. All right. Last question. We have to wrap it up. This has been super fun to catch up.
Yeah.
One of the reasons I wanted to have you on was you've had all these different experiences, and my audience tune in to say they're still thinking about it, that whole identity thing. And they're like, I do want to believe I'm techie, but I don't know if it's really going to happen for me, or like, do I really want this tech thing? And so is it right for me? So what advice would you give to a woman, and in particular a mom, who's like, yeah, I'm ready for my second act and my second act is in tech, but can I do it? What advice would you give her?
I think based on kind of what we just talked about, it's like that question in and of itself, right? Can I do it, or do I want to do it, is as much of an obstacle as anything else that you'll come up against. Mm. I think part of it is decide that this is, I will be techie, but also like, what does it mean to be techie? And I think certainly, you know, in how you talk about it with your audience, you know, there's a certain thought process to it, but is being techie, if you're not working at a tech company, like, does that mean that you're not techie? Like it may not, right? Like your goal may be, yeah, I want to work at a tech company, but you're only half of that equation, right? Like, so success there, if you don't end up at a tech company, then, you know, it's almost considered a failure. So like, for what other reasons would you like, do you love, is there something you love about technology? Is there something that even if you didn't work at a technology company, you would still do techie things because you really enjoy it? Could you start your own projects, right? Like, could you do your own startup? And I think the biggest thing that ends up getting missed is when people think about being techie, you know, again, they think about landing that job. Landing that job, like working for someone else isn't the only way to make money in technology, right? Like, consultants make tons of money. And in a lot of cases, they make more than they would if they were at another company, because these companies don't have to pay, you know, a company you contract for or a company you consult for doesn't have to pay you health insurance. They don't have to pay you social security tax, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Think about and consider independent contracting, right? Like, think about partnering with a company like Gun.io or TopTal or something like that, where if you don't want to be in the business of finding clients, those companies will help you find clients.
Right.
And you are, you know, they're short-term engagements. They're, you know, certain length of time contracts. And it's a lot easier to do something like that than it is necessarily to come into a company cold and say, hey, this is my first job in technology, hire me. It's a lot easier to say, and again, this is if you can afford the time it takes to, you know, kind of build up that reputation. You know, I look at that as, you know, if you're not considering that as an avenue, you know, that you should certainly consider it, because we talk about portfolios and building up a body of work. Well, the easiest way to build up a body of work that's not like, you know, after school projects that you're doing yourself is demonstrating like how you created business value for a company on a less committed basis, right? Like it's a month to month contract or an hourly contract that allows a company and a contractor to try each other out without having to overcommit finances or length of time or whatever. And I think everyone gets something out of it, right? Like you get the experience and the company gets the work done without having to commit an annual salary, right? Like they can be elastic in terms of how they want to spin up or spin down. But yeah, so Gun.io is a company that I've worked with in the past. I've had a really good experience with them. You know, we talked about the acting metaphor. This is like a talent agency. They put you forth for roles and you interview with the companies that have these roles. And some of these roles are 6-month contracts. Some of these roles are 3-week contracts, but they also help you figure out where you stand in certain technologies. So they have their own kind of coding tests and stuff like that. Ooh. So if you want to see where you stack up in terms of certain roles, you know, you can certainly take those. So that would be my advice is really, you know, number one, be mindful of your imposter syndrome. Like the voices in your head for a lot of people are often more negative than they are positive. And so there's all like the obstacles that you might have come from within, but also, if your goal is to work in technology, understand that working for a company full time may not be the only way that you can work in technology. And so either being an independent contractor by finding projects for yourself in your town or in your area, whatever, like that might be a way to do it. Or you can leverage any of these other agencies that, you know, that will help find roles. They'll socialize them to you and they'll advocate for you, especially from a compensation and time perspective. So think about that. It's definitely, you know, I've used them for, you know, side hustle and stuff like that. And I think I look at it as there are a lot of interesting technologies sometimes that you can learn that, you know, might not be as forward, you know, as like obvious as web technologies. And then you can also see what companies are hiring for, which is another interesting. But yeah, I definitely would recommend checking them out because
that's great. I'm not that familiar with them. So we'll link to them in the show notes and make sure.
I'm sure there are a million.
Yeah, others there are too, a lot. Yeah.
Those are two that I'm aware of. And I've worked directly with Gun.io. I haven't worked with TopTal, but again, the premise is it's that gig lifestyle rather than, you know, it's kind of like the Uber for engineering rather than, you know, kind of having to, and cause that was when I was contracting again, when I think about when I got laid off, trying to find contracts or side projects or something that like I could supplement my income with was impossible. And it's like, how do you find the person who is hiring for these roles, you know, and this makes it so easy and, you know, it works out great. And they do a great job representing the talent.
Nick Cooley, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, if you enjoyed listening to this podcast, you have to sign up for the UR Techie email list.
Imagine being in the tech job of your dreams. Join me to get the strategies, training, and never-ending support to get hired. Sign up at urtechie.com. That's YOURETECHY.com. I'll see you next time.